Contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. A conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special Memorial Day edition of the Business of Government Hour. Leaders Speak, a conversation on leadership and public service. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For almost a decade, DC's own The Business of Government Hour has brought you leading government executives who are changing the way government does business. Each week, our guests join us for an informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation about their careers, their agency accomplishments, as well as their vision of government in the 21st century. Over the last 5 years, we've interviewed more than 250 government executives, from department secretaries to C-suite executives. It is from this rich library that we've culled together their insights on topics important to you. This week, Leaders Speak brings you past and current government leaders and their advice on leadership and public service. What makes an effective leader? Why pursue a career in public service? Today, our guests offer their extended reflections on such questions. From saving lives in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina to securing our maritime domain, from championing government management reforms to leading the state of Virginia, our first conversation focuses on leadership with such leading lights as Admiral Thad Allen, Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Clay Johnson, former OMB Deputy Director for Management, and former Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia.
Well, I think every job I've had in the Coast Guard has involved increasing responsibilities and exposure to leadership opportunities. In a way, the best way we can help the Coast Guard is to grow leaders, because we put people in leadership positions much, much earlier than a lot of the other services do. Junior officers coming off their first assignment on a ship can be assigned as commanding officers of patrol boats. We have pilots qualified very, very young. They're out there flying. And we put a lot of responsibility on folks' shoulders early on in their career. That's good and that's bad. It's good in that we get them seasoned early on, and by the time they're mid-grade and senior officers, they've had a lot of operational experiences. The bad part is we got to make sure that the organization that's doing its part in preparing those folks to meet those responsibilities, and that's a tremendous challenge for us. The way we do that, we've developed 21 basic leadership competencies, and whether we're talking about enlisted personnel or cadets at the Coast Guard Academy or officers coming in through OCS, we try and train and teach to those 21 leadership competencies. Well, one of the things I'm trying to do as Commandant is try and get us focused a little bit more strategically and kind of look up over the dashboard to the horizon a little bit. One of the things I tell my folks, and it's very, very easy to fall into this trap in Washington, is we get caught up in what I call the tyranny of the present. Those are the data calls, the questions for the record, the preparations for hearings, all the budget submissions that pervade our daily life around here. And you get so caught up in the annual budget cycle and the annual hearing cycle that it's hard to kind of lift your head up, look over the horizon, and see where you're going. The example we set through our delegation of authority and putting responsibility at the lowest levels in the organization is something that I think everybody would strive to do, and hopefully we're an example in the department to do that. One of the things that allowed us to be successful during the Hurricane Katrina response is that we expected our operational commanders will exercise what we call on-scene initiative. And when we were cut off from higher echelons and communications weren't working down there, everybody knew how to do their job, and they did the right thing, and they did what was expected of them. And I think in the long run, I think that's what the American public and the Secretary would like to see out of this department.
Clay Johnson.
Been challenged in different areas, the for-profit and not-for-profit world and different kinds of industries and companies. And to me, one thing I've learned is that the key is to go in and find out what it is we're trying to accomplish. What is the definition of success? What are our goals? What is the real output we're trying to create? For spending money, what are we buying? How are we going to buy it? And how are we going to assure that we get what we pay for? So key is, let's be real clear about what our goals are. Second key, I think, in terms of management in general is I think the best definition I've ever heard of a manager, and this is the way I try to approach it, is my job is to help the people that work for me be successful, not vice versa. One of the things I make sure is the four or five people that work directly for me are the best that I can find. They are particularly well-suited to accomplish what I think needs to be accomplished in the next 2, 3, 4 years, the typical length of time that someone has a job in the federal government, and that they have lots of expertise, and then I help them be better than they might be without me there. So it's a lot of helping and assisting. That's also the approach that I take working with the agencies. They are, and the agencies are not there to help me accomplish a presidential management priority, the president's agenda, and I are there to help the agencies be more effective at serving their customers. So I think those two general principles I've found myself applying to everything I've been involved in.
At the beginning of his administration, former Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia adopted the motto, Virginia Leading the Way. Here's then-Governor Kaine explaining the motto and outlining his leadership and management approach.
Well, we chose the motto at the beginning of the administration, I think probably somewhat because of we knew we would be commemorating the 400th anniversary, not just of Virginia, but of English-speaking civilization in the New World. Virginia has been a leader for those 400 years. I just want to make sure that we continue to see ourselves that way. We don't want to think of our leadership successes as all in the past. We want to think of them going forward. So the notion that we should be at the front, we should be leading in the creation of new opportunities, new institutions, new ideas, is a powerful one. In terms of, you know, what it says about our management philosophy, you know, sometimes you hear about people, they will separate management and leadership. You know, management is doing things right and leadership is doing the right things. And management is critical. We valued Governing Magazine's accolade a couple years ago, we're the best managed state. But we also want to be leaders, and leadership is a little bit different. I think leadership is often a little bit measured more by kind of the effect that you have on the external world rather than just how you're managing your own little corner of the world. And so I want to make sure that, you know, we hold out before everybody in state government that we're really called to be leaders. We try to define what success is. You know, what are the areas where we want to succeed? So often in organizations, you'll define success by like how hard you're trying, how many meetings you're having, you know, and we try to break out of that and define success by external indicators. What's the state's median income? What's the state's unemployment rate? What percentage of our kids take and pass AP exams when they're in high school? We want to use measures that really define, you know, real world success, not internal process measures of success, outcome measures. That's where the, you know, kind of performance leadership begins. Remember, I go back to my goals plus relationships. I said, we'll spend the first year in defining goals, and then we'll spend 3 years enhancing collaboration, the relationships needed to accomplish the goals.
As a former deputy secretary at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and mayor of Syracuse, New York, Roy Brunardi offers a unique perspective. Good leaders empower others.
I always believed and still do that you may be the person at the top, but if you want something to get done, if you want success, you have to be able to not only choose good people, but to give them the authority to do the things that need to be done, provide them with encouragement, making sure that you have significant amount of quality time with your Syracuse. It was the commissioners and the police chief and the fire chief. And here at HUD now, it's the assistant secretaries and the director of the various programs. You need to, empower is a word that's overused, but you need to let them know that you want them to succeed. I always believe that you set a goal, you have an objective, you let people know what it is, and then you let them, the key word is them, let them do it. You know, don't get in the way, don't micromanage. And I have a personality that I could do that, but I try to not do that. You know, some people will look back at certain presidents and say, gosh, you know, they wanted to get involved in every single detail. I would hope that my management style there is one where people respect me for the work that I do, but they also enjoy the way and appreciate the way I treat them. So respect, understanding, okay, a mistake is made, let them know a mistake is made, and you correct that, you know, no retributions.
Great leaders see opportunities where others see challenges or problems, explains Dave Winogrand, Deputy CIO at the Department of Defense.
Change happened, get used to it. Exactly. Is that right? Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is one of my favorite subjects because it, I don't know, it smacks on human nature and psychology and all sorts of interesting disciplines. It really is at the heart of everything that we do. Organizations are often the last thing to change. It takes a long time to shut down an organization, as they say, tear down the flagpole, right? Move buildings and those sorts of things. But the challenges have spanned organizational boundaries. So getting people to function as a team is hugely important. When I was the deputy CIO for the Navy, we cared enough about this, we actually wrote a book called The Power of Team. And it was geared to help organizations create effective CIO organizations. And the only way to have an effective CIO organization is to have an effective team. And so this idea about being a positive force for change and being able to work with rather than work against others is hugely important. It doesn't have to be a case of my victory is at the expense of your defeat, right? We really can find ways if we work together that it will be better than if we went our own individual ways. There's lots of great leadership books about this. One of my favorites is Max Dupree's book, Leadership is an Art. And it's just fascinating. He has this great quote about great leaders see opportunities where others see challenges or problems. And that really is the key. Are you going to be a cynical voice for change or a positive voice for change? I think people fail to recognize that if you're an IT professional, whether you're in government or industry, you are viewed by all of your peers as knowing more about this subject. And so your level of cynicism, your level of reticence, your level of reluctance or fear becomes like a magnifier for them. It's a resonator. It's like the ripples in the pond, right? A little bit of perturbation on your part creates great angst in the rest of the workforce. It's not to say that you want to endorse things that are bad ideas, but to the extent that things are a good idea, you have to be an avid vocal storyteller about why they're a good idea. It's no surprise that, if you drew a bell curve of an organization, the majority of people are not like early adopters of change. They're change neutral or change averse. And so if you want to get an organization to move from where it is to where it will be, you have to help the organization have courage and be willing to understand the new idea. We often underestimate the power and importance of storytelling. You can't do it alone, right? Everybody has to be a good storyteller. Everybody has to work together as a team. There's another great book that I love. Forgive me, I have lots of books that I love. But another great one is the book Execution by Larry Bossidy and Ram Charan. And in it, they have a fabulous quote that says, leaders get the behaviors that they exhibit and tolerate. And it is so true. If you're going to be a positive force for change, if you're going to be a leader of teams that are empowered to do great things, wonderful things will happen. If you're not, then you'll fret and fear and things won't get done. Leaders help others find their gifts and find their talents and help create a better future. If you empower smart people to get the job done, amazing things will happen. If you feed their creativity and don't be an impediment in their way, but support them as they go, fabulous results will happen.
Our conversation on public service will continue when Leaders Speak, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, returns.
Check out the new Fall-Winter 2009 issue of the Business of Government magazine. Don't miss conversations with leaders. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, discusses infectious diseases such as the 2009 H1N1 flu virus and other emerging and re-emerging infectious disease. Admiral Thad Allen, Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, explains his successful use of social media tools, Coast Guard modernization, and the U.S. Arctic policy. Order or download a free copy of the Fall-Winter 2009 The Business of Government magazine by going to thebusinessofgovernment.org.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on leadership and public service. Rob Carey, CIO with the Department of the Navy, recognizes the I say, you do form of leadership is not very effective.
I have learned over time and watching my bosses, I've always been fortunate to have really good bosses by and large, and you learn from them, watch what succeeds and what doesn't succeed. You learn that the I say you do mentality of the old Navy doesn't work very well. You learn that consensus building and team-based approaches, obtaining buy-in early on, works a whole lot better because if people are not surprised when they see change coming, or if they were a part of it when it was being developed, they will embrace it a whole lot better and try to make it go. So my leadership style has been influenced by my experiences in the uniform Navy as well as my civilian assignments. to be collaborative, to be team-based, to be one of obtaining consensus before we move on.
The head of DOD's Lean Six Sigma program and retired U.S. Army Colonel J.D. Cecilia reflects on how his military experience has shaped how he leads.
I think the one that they stress in the military and one that stays with you even after you retire is you always have to lead by an example. Lead by example. As an officer in the military, you always seek to attain the highest qualifications that you can in your profession so that you can better lead others. That's what leads officers to go to airborne school, ranger school, those type of leadership development schools. When I got into Lean Six Sigma, I understood that, you know, to lead a group, I would have to be an expert in my field. And so that's why I pursued certification at the Master Black Belt level. And I believe that that has paid huge dividends in understanding what it is that we're trying to lead and the methodology behind it. So lead by example, I think, is the number one lesson I learned that I've carried on through the civilian career. The next one I believe that remains true is volunteer for the hard jobs. There's usually not a line forming for that. And so even though they will be hard to accomplish, there's a greater sense of satisfaction when you complete them. The next one I believe is very important is choose your team wisely. I've had the great opportunity to form three different teams since I've become a civilian, the great privilege to stand up three different organizations, and with that came the opportunity to hire people. And the lesson I take with that is you can tell within about 10 minutes conversation or an interview what the person is really like. And there are certain characteristics that make a great Lean Six Sigma practitioner, and you can't teach those. Another one is that failure is not an option. It's one of those, you know, we're going to succeed, and we're just going to keep working until we do. And the last one, we have a common goal, and that is the success of the warfighter. Whether you're in uniform or out of uniform, I mean, we have the common objective of creating the best support system we can so that those on the front lines get what they need, they get it in a timely fashion, and they get it every time the right way.
Ambassador Patrick Kennedy, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of State, explains what his long and varied career has taught him about leadership.
Well, I joined the Foreign Service 35 years ago, shortly after graduating from college. I spent my first two tours in the Foreign Service in the Bureau of African Affairs, and then secondly came back to Washington after that to become the personnel officer for the Bureau of African Affairs, and went on from there to be a special assistant to the Undersecretary for Management, went to Paris, then as the General Services Officer in that State Department lingo for the Logistics and Maintenance Officer, came back to Washington, spent 5 years as the Executive Director of the Secretariat, went on to Cairo, which was and still is one of the largest U.S. embassies in the world, was Chief of Administration there, came back to Washington, was Assistant Secretary of State for Administration for a number of years, went to New York. I was one of the deputies to John Negroponte when he was the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. And during my time in New York, I was twice detailed to Iraq, the first in 2003 for about 6.5 months. And I was the Chief of Staff for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, then went back in 2004 to do the transition from a Department of Defense-run CPA to the new American Embassy. At the end of my four-year tenure in New York, I went to Office of National Intelligence and again worked for John Negroponte and helped him set up the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And then in 2007, came back to the State Department. That sort of long and varied career, I think, is taught me a couple of things. The first is the importance of people. You get things done if you have a good team. But I think what I've learned is people will respond to a mission. They'll respond to tough and difficult assignments if you sit them down and explain, this is our goal. This is why that goal is so important. This is your individual mission in supporting that goal. This is how you fit into the big picture. Give them that assignment and then let them do their job. Second thing I learned that operations overseas are different than they are in Washington. It's not that it's better, it's just different. And having served overseas, it gives you the context as you're now trying to manage something in Washington in support of the field. You have to keep always in mind that things are different. The third thing, I guess, is that there are always problems that arise. You have to be creative and flexible. Events happen overseas, some good, some bad, but you have to be always prepared to surge resources, to operate almost instantaneously, to either protect the lives of American citizens, to working to protect American embassies when they come under attack.
For Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director, National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, leaders must lead by example.
Well, I think they're critical. The art of persuasion as well as sticking to your principles. A leader must lead by example. You have to understand the subject and the terrain in which you're trying to lead. And you have to show that you are doing the leading and you're a part of the process as opposed to telling people what to do. You've got to get them to feel that they have an investment in it. You've got to persuade them that this is something that's important, that's exciting, and they're doing it not because you're pushing them to do it, because they really do want to do it. And I think that's the secret of a leader in the arena of persuading somebody to get very, very much involved. With regard to principles, you have to set up a fundamental group of principles, particularly in the arena of science, because science is uncompromising. It's trying to get to the truth. It's trying to understand and get knowledge of things that would ultimately, in the biological sciences, help humanity. So you can never compromise your scientific principles. If you do that, first of all, you're not worth much, and you're going to wind up getting yourself in trouble.
Dr. Carolyn Clancy, Director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, says leaders must bring everyone to the table.
Well, probably the first experience, but it's always fundamental, is that I'm the oldest of a large family. I'm the oldest of seven. And I, of course, think I was never bossy, but my siblings might have a different story to tell. A lot of experiences I had at the Medical College of Virginia were incredibly helpful. The first was that we actually began to explore how do you assess the quality of care in outpatient settings. This was before health plans were reporting on quality and so forth, and I called everyone I knew around the country to say, so how do you do this? And people didn't have a whole lot to say, so we just did the very best that we could. And that included actually evaluating some of how we were educating patients, which no one had done that I could find out about or certainly read about in the literature. So that was a great learning about what does it take to figure out where are the areas where we can improve care, how can we figure out relatively easily and efficiently how we're doing, and then what is the strategy for trying to make sure that we do a better job. That was very exciting for me. Being the medical director for this clinic also gave me the opportunity to work with pharmacists who were incredible partners for us, as well as nurses and nurse practitioners and the hospital administrators, because we were a hospital-based clinic. And from the get-go, I could see that to actually make an organization effective, you had to have everyone at the table making shared decisions. Some would call this matrix management. It's not always easy, but it's incredibly important.
Our conversation on public service will continue when Leaders Speak, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, returns.
Check out the new Fall-Winter 2009 issue of the Business of Government magazine. Don't miss conversations with leaders. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, discusses infectious diseases such as the 2009 H1N1 flu virus and other emerging and re-emerging infectious disease. Admiral Thad Allen, commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, explains his successful use of social media tools, Coast Guard modernization, and the U.S. Arctic policy. Order or download a free copy of the Fall-Winter 2009 The Business of Government magazine by going to thebusinessofgovernment.org.
Listen next week for the Business of Government Hour's Conversation with Author series exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness. What is cloud computing? How can states use process improvement methods to transform service delivery? And how to use geographic information systems to enhance citizen engagement? The show will profile three IBM Center reports and explore these questions with Dr. David Wild, Dr. Vicki Grant, and Professor Sukumar Ganapati. Join host Michael Keegan next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Leaders Speak, a conversation on leadership and public service. The need for leaders may be most important in public service, for it determines whether government programs will be run efficiently and produce the performance and results citizens expect and deserve. Leaders beget leaders. It's about inspiring the next generation to serve and transform the way government works.
I think the single most important thing that has prepared me is I've been very, very fortunate at just about every point in my career to have a good set of mentors and supervisors and leaders from myself that I could try and model in very imperfect and inadequate ways, but nonetheless, you know, see how what they were doing and then do my best to take from that and give back and use that as my approach to management. One of the key things that I learned, you know, from managers all throughout that I've had the honor to work for is the importance of collaboration, the importance of bringing people in to decisions, both to get, you know, the best guidance and perspective that from people when I have to make a decision, but also to get buy-in from those that would be affected by that decision. And I've always found that, you know, that to be the key to any good decision I've ever made is making sure that I've reached out and brought in the right set of people. And fortunately, there have only been a few cases, but in those few cases that I know of that I thought, geez, I didn't handle that right. If there's been a common element, it's been I didn't involve the people that I could have and should have involved in that decision. So I've been at GAO about 25 years now, and it's just a fantastic place to work. What I have found is obviously, first and foremost, it's the quality of the colleagues that you have at GAO and the people that you get to work with. I mean, every single day, every single meeting that I go into, I'm just re-impressed about the intellect, experience, sophistication of my colleagues at GAO. Likewise, it's the ability to work on a variety of wide-ranging issues that really matter. And then the third thing that I find so appealing about GAO is how much we do try and track the results of our work. We work so hard to make sure we understand the results that taxpayers get from their investment in GAO. I firmly believe, and I've said this very often, that this is the most exciting time in at least a generation to be involved in the public service. And it turns on the two things that I mentioned just a moment ago, the long-term fiscal challenges and the governance issues. And the challenges that federal managers face, the decisions that federal decision makers face in the executive branch and in Congress are really unprecedented in the scope that they confront. The need for good information, the need for good managers, the need for good people to help us navigate our way through these enormous challenges that we as a country face in the next 5, 10, 15 years is just enormous. And so it's an exciting time and a very challenging time to be involved in public management. That's the first point that I would make to people. The second point that I would make is that, you know, the importance of service is that it's through all the heroic efforts that agencies have been making under the Government Performance and Results Act, we are getting these lines of sight in agencies where individual programs are better able to show demonstrable results from their work. That's something that people can come into government from and have complete confidence that what they're working on is improving the lives and livelihood of their fellow citizens. And that's a very, very big deal for people. And so it's both kind of the intellectual excitement and the just the opportunity to be a part of something big, as well as the opportunity to return something to our fellow citizens, I think are two very important reasons to be involved in the public service.
That was Chris Mim, Managing Director, Strategic Issues Group at GAO, on the importance of public service in the 21st century. Semper Paratus, always ready, is the motto of the U.S. Coast Guard, as in always ready to serve. Admiral Thad Allen, Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, discusses his path to public service.
Well, whether it's a career in public service or the Coast Guard, you need to understand that when you're involved in public service, in addition to the compensation that you get that may not be as great as you would be able to enjoy in the private sector, you're being compensated psychologically for doing something for your country, and there's a notion of service and serving something that's bigger than yourself when you do that. And I think that's embodied in public service. It's particularly embodied in service in the Coast Guard. And the advice I usually give folks is that, number one, you need to understand that you're serving the country Number two, you need to get up every day and go to work and enjoy it. And if you're not, then you should do something else. And number three, if you're coming home from work and you're not enjoying it, then you need to look at yourself and what's going on in your personal life. I think the Coast Guard has got it right in our core values of honor, respect, and devotion to duty. And when people are looking to come in the Coast Guard, I would just say they need to think about those three core values. And I think of them as concentric circles when I'm talking to young folks in the Coast Guard. The first one is honor. And that's the compact you make with yourself on how you're going to conduct your life and the principles you're going to live by. Respect, which is the next one, is how you're going to conduct your life in relation to those around you. The compact you make with your teammates, your office mates, the people in your own organization. A devotion to duty is a compact you make with your country. So honor, respect, and devotion to duty I see as concentric circles that build the individual from their self out to that larger sense of duty that's related to the blue uniform we all wear.
Recognized as one of the best places to work by the Partnership for Public Service, the Office of Management and Budget has always had a reputation for being very demanding and a stressful place to work. Clay Johnson, former Deputy Director for Management at OMB, explains why.
I think the reason why the 500 or so employees at OMB are so pleased to be there is that it is the center of the government universe. Everything that moves in the federal government involves OMB. It involves money or it involves how money is spent. And so if you want to be where the action is, OMB is it. The standards of the employees we hire across the government are high. So I don't know that we hire dramatically more talented employees or our standards are higher. Our standards are higher, but so are the labor departments and so are the interior departments. But we throw our employees into the middle of things very quickly. They understand that their work is very, very important. And they are part of getting things done. Sometimes their recommendations are accepted. Sometimes they're not. But when an item comes into OMB, it's a proposal. It's a new program that someone wants to put in place yesterday. It's not something that they're thinking about doing in 2012. There's a lot of urgency to address the request for money, or there's a lot of urgency to develop a budget, or there's a lot of urgency to figure out the best way to structure a program to cause the money to be spent most responsibly. There's a very short time frame for everything that goes on in OMB, and then a decision gets made or it's not. And then Congress approves it or it's not in a matter of months. So you can see the benefit, the results of your actions very, very quickly, and you know that you've participated in causing a new program to get launched or an old one to get reconstituted or some things to be combined or monies to be spent more in this area and less in that area. There's a great esprit de corps there. Some people stay a long time. Some people go from there to other parts of the federal government with great training, and we welcome people who want to stay there for their whole career, and we welcome people that want to spend a few years there and go on. It's just a great, great place. There's great pride of accomplishment and effort. That's one that benefits from being small in size. 500 people, everybody can be very plugged into what's going on there and kept very knowledgeable, and they can hear from their senior management how much they're respected and loved by the management and regarded by all the federal government.
Judy Tillman, former commissioner at the Department of the Treasury, relishes her 35 years in public service as a meaningful venture.
And my advice to others that are considering a career in public service would just be to do it. The opportunity for public service is so meaningful. The work is fascinating. You know, I've been talking for an hour now about financial systems and accounting, which may sound kind of boring, and yet I have to tell you, it's been the most fascinating work that I have ever done. And one of the great things about public service is that it's easy to move between agencies. You can still have a life outside work if you want to. But also, if you want to really work very hard, you can have all kinds of opportunities to grow, develop, excel, and you can make a real contribution to the American taxpayer. And in particular, I have to say that the Treasury Department is a great agency to work for. It's an agency with high integrity, and it performs functions that are critical to the nation and critical to every citizen on an individual basis. And I would not change my 35 years at Treasury for anything.
Public service can enable one to be a positive force for change. Ambassador Patrick Kennedy at the State Department makes a strong case for foreign service as public service.
Well, the first thing I would tell him is to apply to the State Department first. Do not apply to any other government agency. We want you. The State Department is an incredibly challenging activity. If you want a job that will change every day, whether you're in Washington or whether you're overseas, the opportunities the state has across the board, everything from information technology to medical to logistics to refugees to consular work to legal, I think we have jobs there that will challenge everyone. I think also that one has to realize that the government is a hierarchical organization, and you are probably going to start at the bottom. But every day will be a challenge. Every day will be an education. Every day you will have prepared yourself another 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours to do what the American people need. I encourage people to apply to state because I think that we have the careers and we have the opportunities. The State Department is America's front line. We try desperately to do our job. We are not a perfect organization. I encourage your listeners or their friends who have any questions about the State Department or any of the services we provide, our website, www.state.gov, is robust. I encourage your listeners to go there, and we're here to serve you, and I believe that you'll be able to find the answers and support you need.
According to Michael Astru, head of the Social Security Administration, your fate is largely within your control, but don't overplan.
When I was in college, most of my classmates had career plans, and I set out sort of simplistically just to have an interesting and valuable life and just not worry about where it took me. So initially, it took me here in Washington, and I worked for a couple years in the Senate for some nonprofit agencies. I went back to law school, worked briefly in the private sector, and then came back into government at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And I worked there for most of the next 8 years. I also had a short stint over at the White House. And then when that was over, I went into biotech, and I got a lot of the same satisfaction being in biotechnology that I did from public service. My companies were fairly small, generally working at devastating diseases that the big companies had overlooked. So I really felt every day that I was doing something special and important. So I did that for about 14 years. But then when the opportunity came around to basically come back home to Social Security, I found that pretty irresistible. I think the most important thing is to don't overplan and just go out and do what you believe in and do what seems valuable. You know, I've had to reinvent myself a number of times, both in the public sector and the private sector. And I think that it's given me opportunities I've never dreamed possible. So when I talk to our leadership classes, one of the things I tend to hit hard on is that, you know, your fate's largely within your control. If you keep investing in yourself, keep trying new things, keep challenging new things, make sacrifices for the organization earlier in your career, and show that you can do different things, you're just more likely to be there and be the person that has to answer the call, you know, when you've stepped up in the organization a little bit. So I think that's what I preach for the most part.
For Roy Bernardi, former city mayor and deputy secretary at HUD, next to family, answering the call of public service is one of the highest callings.
I started my career working in city government as the city auditor quite a while back. I was elected to that position and served in that position for 18 years and ran for mayor back in 1993. It wasn't my first run for mayor, so for the young folks that are out there listening about career paths and opportunities, you know, don't give up if you don't succeed the first time. But I ran in 1981, ran in 85, and came very close both times. 1993 was the year for me, and reelected in 97, reelected. Being mayor of any city is the nicest job, perhaps, that anyone could want, but it's also the most difficult job in the United States, with perhaps the exception of presidency, because you're right there with the people. You go into a grocery store, you're on the street, and everyone comes up and everyone has a condition or a circumstance that they want addressed. It was a wonderful 7.5 years. I was asked by the administration to come down in 2001, and I did that, and I left the term 6 months before it expired. But I had the opportunity to crime reduction, economic development. The city ended up with a nice surplus in the bank. We have a excellent public works department. We brought jobs and we brought companies into downtown Syracuse. We did an awful lot of restoration. We did an awful lot of remediation of contaminated properties. Even at HUD, people call me the mayor more than they call me the deputy secretary. Just a wonderful experience. Public services is a great career, and I would encourage anyone who, especially the younger folks out there, to take a look at it. You know, people will do something in life for many different reasons, hopefully because they enjoy it. I would tell anyone out there, if you don't enjoy what you do, then run away from it. You have to like what you do, just like your folks sitting here. And you can make a lot of money. You're not going to do it in government. I tell folks that, tell young folks that especially. But there's also something about, you know, an accomplishment, what makes you tick inside. And I think all of us, regardless of where we come from, regardless of our standing, regardless of our economic situation, when you're able to help, that's the word, when you're able to help someone, it makes you feel good. That's what public service is all about. You're helping people. So I would say to everyone, it's the highest calling after your family. It's the highest calling to help other people.
As a former mayor and then governor, here's Tim Kaine of Virginia sharing his perspective on public service.
Well, first, do it. I think in some ways the barriers to public service are getting higher. Financial sacrifice, you know, being in the press, and the press can be a little bit merciless. Hey, we're all going to make mistakes. If you make a mistake in your own personal circle, they will give you the benefit of the doubt. If you're in public life and make a mistake, people don't usually want to give you the benefit of the doubt. So there are a lot of reasons why it can be hard to be in public service, but it is enormously satisfying. You know, I don't have any illusions. People have short attention spans, so a few years after I'm governor, you know, most people will look at me and they won't know I was governor. They'll think I did the weather or something. But I can drive by things in my community that wouldn't be there if it weren't for me. You know, as mayor, I got a bunch of schools built. As governor, I've now seen a college open in a hard-hit part of the state that didn't exist before I really started pushing the idea. I can drive around my city and around my commonwealth for the rest of my life and see things that have my thumbprint on them. That is an enormously satisfying feeling. And so for all the, you know, reasons that make it hard to get into public life, what I would say to anybody is that you can make a mark on your community in a way that will give you a feeling of satisfaction that is very, you know, that's just very powerful. There's a lot of opportunities, more than you might think. As governor of Virginia, I've already done in 16 months probably 1,700 appointments of Virginia citizens to boards and commissions, part-time, voluntary, on economic development, education, health care, agriculture, policy. We get citizens engaged all the time. At the local level, it's the same, whether it's a library board, a PTA, running for school board. There are so many opportunities, you know, for you to engage. I mean, it really is a government by, of, and for the people. I mean, it is of the people. There are opportunities for you to get in, and whether you want to spend an hour a week or full time helping your government be more responsive and do the things that you think ought to be done, there's a lot of opportunities for you, and they are also some very satisfying opportunities.
Former Governor Kaine notes there's a lot more opportunities in public service than you might think. Scientist, teacher, and former Undersecretary for Science at the U.S. Department of Energy, Dr. Raymond Orbach, brings this point home.
I've had quite a long history in academia. I did my research work at Oxford as a postdoc, and then I came to Harvard as an assistant professor. Spent a few years there, and then the lure of California, where I come from, was very great, and I joined the faculty at UCLA. There, I filled a number of scientific and also administrative positions, and after 20 years was appointed as the first provost of the College of Letters and Science at UCLA. It's a large institution, so I grew up learning about administration in real time as I grappled with curriculum and students and their needs during that decade. I was then asked to become chancellor of the University of California, Riverside, where I spent the next 10 years. So my experience in the University of California has lasted almost 40 years. Well, 40 years is a long time to be with a single institution, and so I retired in the beginning of 2002. And simultaneous with that, President Bush invited me to serve as the director of the Office of Science. If you think about art and you think about a painting, you're taught that your eye automatically gravitates to the upper right-hand corner. And so the artist then puts together his painting, his tableau, in such a way that your eye is drawn to that corner. If it's not, you're troubled, and the artist can trouble you by coming up with a painting that makes you feel uneasy. Scientists do the same thing. Scientific discovery is not some set of equations that we know and we write down and we solve and eureka. Scientific discovery is coming up with something completely new. Quite often when we discover things, they're so complex and so cumbersome that we wonder whether they really are true or not. And scientists have a tendency to think that they have finally gotten the answer when it's beautiful, when it's simple, when suddenly they see that all of that complexity can be bottled up in a relatively simple expression or simple structure. It's that aesthetic feeling of simplicity that drives discovery and makes one feel that you have created something. I often say to young people, how many fields in the world can you work in that you have a discovery that is yours, that no one can take away from you? You're the one that figured it out, and everybody else who comes along after knows that. That is so exciting. It's also terribly difficult. More often than not, it's very frustrating where you keep going down wrong paths, and you know they're wrong because in order to explain it, it's too complex. There's something wrong out there. So it's that aesthetic sense of simplicity that I think is behind scientific discovery and which keeps us going, just as exactly as an artist does when they describe their tableau. I view public service as a payback. My own career has been very generously supported by people through their taxes and by our federal government. I view the opportunity of coming to Washington and doing the best job I can as a way of expressing my thanks to this country for the wonderful opportunities it has given me. I would advise young people to get into discovery. It doesn't matter if it's the physical sciences, the mathematics, biological sciences, the science of discovery. It is so exciting, and it has with it a rigor and a process that they will find invaluable in other fields. I would then ask them, over time, to think about payback, about giving this marvelous country of ours a return on its investment in us. That's the way I view federal service, state service, teaching, local service. Each of us expresses our thanks for the support our country has given us through these vehicles.
Leading the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases for over 25 years gives Dr. Anthony Fauci valuable insight into medical research as public service.
Well, I first came to the NIH back after my internship and residency in internal medicine. I trained at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center, and I wanted to do a fellowship in a combination of immunology and infectious diseases. At that time, human immunology was still in its infancy as a discipline, but it was very exciting. I also was very interested in infectious diseases and its impact on global health. Came to the NIH, did a three-year fellowship in combined infectious diseases and clinical immunology. In fact, I have my boards in actually three specialties, internal medicine, infectious diseases, and clinical immunology and allergy, even though fundamentally I'm a clinical infectious disease person who looks at immunological research related to the host-microbe interaction. And I did that starting after my chief residency came down here and worked my way from being a senior invest fellow to a senior investigator to a laboratory chief. And then in 1984, I became the director of the Institute. So it was fundamentally my love for and excitement about infectious diseases. And your question about why I've stayed there for 25 years as the director and even more so as a member of the NIH team is that what I'm doing is very exciting, and it constantly changes. When I first came there, there were people who were saying that the era of infectious diseases was over and that we should be concentrating our resources on chronic diseases since we have vaccines and therapeutics and diagnostics and things like that. Well, that statement could not have been more incorrect, because not too soon after I got there, HIV came upon the scene, which really transformed my professional life, my personal life, and everything that I did, because that was my area of research, as well as one of the most important areas of the Institute that I was soon to become the director of. So it was a constellation of events that occurred that got me where I am and keeps me where I am. Well, my advice to a person is that you need to do what feels good for you, and you should at least give a consideration for and think about the possibility of biomedical sciences in the form of something related to health, either as a physician or as a physician scientist or as a pure scientist, because the rewards of doing something in a public service way for mankind, you can't pay enough for that. That's a feeling that is a very, very wonderful, sustaining feeling about feeling good about yourself. So if there's any possibility that a young person is interested in pursuing a career in this particular area, namely health, I strongly encourage that person to at least pursue and investigate whether or not that is something that you really want to do with yourself. It's not for everyone, and I don't think that if you don't do it that there's something wrong with you, but if you have any inkling or tendency to want to do that, you should at least pursue it and see if it's for you.
For Dr. Carolyn Clancy, Director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, public service combines her love of science and putting people's health first.
So I grew up just outside of Boston, and somewhere around age 9 decided I wanted to be a doctor based on I have no idea what. Over the years, I realized it was probably a good idea that I recognized in maybe a preconscious way in fourth grade, because I really like science, but I also liked working with people. So I went to Boston College. I then went to medical school in Massachusetts and ultimately did residency there and went on to do a fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania. I had been encouraged by a mentor when I was doing my clinical training to at least consider academic medicine, that it should be, I should make an explicit decision not to do it rather than sort of drift and not think about it. So I actually did a fellowship in something called general medicine, which was all about the kind of research that ARC does. And I was particularly interested in clinical decision making. How is it that doctors can keep many factors in their heads and try to tailor all the science that we've learned to meet the needs and preferences of the specific individual you're dealing with? That's what makes it fun. That's what makes it totally not an algorithm or a protocol. That is the part that doctors talk about as being incredibly meaningful about their daily work. But I wanted to know more about what were the kinds of factors that affected that and so forth. I took a position with the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, Virginia, on the faculty and continued to do some research and did a lot of teaching. And ultimately, I became the medical director of our primary care clinic. Now, in Virginia, care for those who have no insurance is often augmented in addition to Medicaid and other public programs by money from the state that goes to the medical schools. So we probably served something like 30,000 patients, two-thirds or so of whom came from the city of Richmond, but another third came from outlying areas. So providing them with continuity of care was very challenging. Increasingly, I began to worry about what were the policies that might actually make this situation better for all of those patients? We were trying as hard as we could, and I was very impressed by the residents and how much they cared about their patients. But at the end of the day, I could see that what we needed were policies that actually helped us expand access to care for those patients. So that interest in policy was really what brought me to Washington. I have found both to be incredibly exciting and gratifying. So anyone who's interested, I would say go for it, because there are going to be multiple possible paths, but also be open to the idea that there'll be many different opportunities. I never, ever, as a resident, would have thought I'd be doing anything like what I'm doing today. And I hear that from healthcare professionals in all walks of life. Many people have changed careers multiple times, but that's actually a terrifically good thing because you get to test different skills and so forth. So I would give them as much encouragement as possible. Let me also just say that I'm also a bit humble by this question because I originally came to ARC in late 1990 to stay for 2 years, and my expectation was I'd go back to academic medicine, and I've been there ever since, and it's been fabulous. But it always does temper my sense of being too confident when giving career counseling.
Dave Winogren, Deputy CIO at DOD, understands non-traditional paths to public service firsthand.
I probably have a non-traditional path for a CIO kind of guy because I didn't grow up as an IT professional. I came to work for the Department of the Navy as a civilian employee directly out of college. And I've had a number of different jobs. At one point in my career, I did the public-private competitions of the OMB A76 program. I did the base closure rounds of the 90s for the Navy. I was involved after the base closure rounds with insulation management and logistics work, where one of my jobs was to go and reorganize the bases that didn't close. Some people say that's like running from one program of hate and discontent to another, but I am a hopeless optimist, so I like to think that they're all programs that help people deal with change. Well, it's been a fabulous opportunity for me, and I think people choose one of two career paths. Some people, you know, have very organized career paths when they plan they're going to do this for 2 years and do that for 3 years and plan out their whole lives. I kind of have managed my career by chaos, you know. one adventure has led to another, and I've been very fortunate in where those adventures have led. I think working for the federal government has been great. It is a wonderful opportunity. You know, you get a chance to get leadership experience very early. In the military and in the civil service, you know, you're a leader of large groups of people at a very young age. And so you learn leadership skills quickly, and you get to work on some things that are very big stages. The scope and size of the military departments and the Department of Defense is unrivaled pretty much anywhere. And so you get to be part of something really big. It does take the right blend of patience and impatience. Large organizations are like large ships. They sometimes turn slowly. You need to be impatient because you need to keep pushing for the next thing to happen. You need to have a certain amount of patience, though, so you don't become too frustrating where sometimes you butt heads or don't make progress as fast as you like. But I think it's been a really rewarding experience for me, and I think it's an opportunity for somebody to be a positive force for change and make a difference quickly.
For our guest today, being a positive force for change, making a difference, serving others, and leading by example are characteristics of an effective public servant. We hope you've enjoyed today's discussion on leadership and public service. This has been Leaders Speak, a special Memorial Day edition of the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation on leadership and public service. As we commemorate Memorial Day, let's remember all the men and women who have given their lives in service to our country. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thank you for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. and visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
Check out the new Fall/Winter 2009 issue of the Business of Government magazine. Don't miss conversations with leaders. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, discusses infectious diseases such as the 2009 H1N1 flu virus and other emerging and re-emerging infectious disease. Admiral Thad Allen, commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, explains his successful use of social media tools, Coast Guard modernization, and the U.S. Arctic policy. Order or download a free copy of the Fall/Winter 2009 The Business of Government magazine by going to thebusinessofgovernment.org.
Listen next week for the Business of Government Hour's conversation with author series exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness. What is cloud computing? How can states use process improvement methods to transform service delivery? And how to use geographic information systems to enhance citizen engagement? The show will profile three IBM Center reports and explore these questions with Dr. David Wild, Dr. Vicki Grant, and Professor Sukumar Ganapati. Join host Michael Keegan next week on the Business of Government Hour. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy Midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics and your source for federal news now.
CNN Radio, I'm Jim.